Well, Izzy Lomax-Sawyers is a junior doctor who's chronicled her first year working in one of New Zealand's busiest hospitals, Middlemore. In between early morning ward rounds, endless overtime, gruelling night shifts and a pandemic, Izzy has written a funny and at times heartbreaking account of her first year as a doctor. Vital Signs follows her as she rotates through psychiatry, orthopaedics, medicine and surgery, as she grapples with death, diagnosis, sleep deprivation, at a lot of highs and lows. Izzy Lomax-Sawyers is with us from Christchurch, where she's now based. Kia ora, Izzy. Welcome.
Kia ora. Thank you.
So everyone wants to know around here, you wrote this during the Omicron peak. How on earth did you find the time? Was it a kind of, debrief that you were able to do as part of dealing with all that stress?
Yeah, I ask myself daily how I found the time, to be honest with you. I think when you've got these kind of stories about work brimming in your head with not really anywhere to put them, going home and writing is a pretty good way to get them out. So, yeah.
That's interesting. It was actually almost like a journal in some ways, and a way of managing, navigating a really difficult time, as it is for any doctor. Yeah. The first chapter of the book's pretty much a minute-by-minute account of a regular day as a house officer, and it's exhausting just to be reading it. Do you want to just give listeners a sense of how frantic that job can be?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first chapter of Vital Signs is basically about being on a ward round as a junior doctor, and the ward rounds where all of the doctors, the more senior ones and the junior ones like me, go and see every patient under their care, decide what the plan is for today. Do we need some more scans? Do we need different blood tests? And while you're trying to see all of these patients, make plans and make sure they're documented, at the same time your phone's ringing and you never know what's going to be on the other end of the phone. Sometimes it's because a patient needs a laxative, and sometimes it's because a patient's deteriorated and might be dying. And so that first chapter is really about the constant ringing of the phone and the constant running around from job to job and never having time to pee.
It's also indicative of what it is that you're having to make decisions on, even as a junior doctor, how much learning has gone on. But the sheer diversity of what you'd be asked about or what a patient's dealing with, you're testing, aren't you, whether all that academic research and indeed the postings you've had is going to work for you. It's being tested day by day by day.
It is, yeah. And I mean, you're doing it with a lot of support to start out with. And, you know, you sort of have these dreams when you finish medical school that you're going to rock up and, you know, be saving lives and making a huge difference from day one. And in reality, you aren't quite sure how many potassium tablets to chart, and you have to ask someone senior what to do. And so you do start out with a lot of support and a lot of people to ask, but it still feels like a huge amount of responsibility, and it's really scary at times.
In one instance you're describing, you walk in and someone is essentially in cardiac arrest and no one knows why. I'm just thinking about, this is where you find out, isn't it? This is where you find out whether you can do this or not.
Yeah, I think so. To be fair, you don't meet many people who find that they can't do it. I think it's where you find out just what you're made of when the chips are down, and just how much the rehearsal and the training that we do when the stakes are much lower kick in when things need to be done straight away, and when your brain's not working in the way that it does when you're relaxing.
Huh. Was it a shock, or did you just start running and keep running?
I think it's a shock to the system at first. Starting work's a shock to the system, and every new rotation feels like a shock to the system. The thing about being a junior doctor is you do about 3 months, at least as a house officer, which is the job I do now, you do about 3 months on each specialty and then move on. So you start out and you don't know any of the special words the nurses are using and any of the special medicines that the specialty prescribes, and you have to look everything up and ask about everything. And then you get a little bit better and you start to think you're pretty good at this, and then you move on to a new rotation and you've got no idea what's going on again. So it's kind of a constant shock to the system, I think, and every emergency and every kind of serious patient deterioration, you get a little more used to them. But for me, I still find that I'm a little shaken when someone's become really sick, and it's been my job to make sure that they get the best care.
Gosh, there's a line in there, I'm just trying to remember it. And it's just, this is the brutal honesty that occurs in the book. You know, there are any number of ways in which we could harm a patient or stuff up a patient, you know. And this is the responsibility that you carry. You're trained, you've learned what you need to know, you know what you need to do, but from time to time, that responsibility really stands right in front of you.
It does, yeah. And, you know, I guess we all hope that the system's going to catch us if we find that because we're human beings, we make a mistake, or, you know, that we're not quite up to the challenge of a complex patient deterioration. And I guess, you know, most of the time it does. But the fear of harming someone, I don't think it ever really goes away. And I think that doctors who have harmed someone, because if you're in this job for long enough, doesn't matter how many times you've done the right thing, at some point you will have done the wrong thing. I think that really sticks with them.
You write at one point, the terror made me safe in a way. I checked and rechecked everything I did. And that other point you just made there, the feeling, and there was someone at some point who gave you advice, and you said, do you always stay feeling this bad when someone dies? And that person said to you, well, you kind of have to move on because you can't be sad all the time. But for you, that was kind of a struggle as well. You would worry about patients when you were at home, and you would feel when someone died.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a real challenge as a doctor, I suppose, that the balance between being a human being and feeling the natural way that a human being feels when something horrible happens to someone else, and also trying to have a life of your own and not be sad every time you go home at the end of the day. And I think a lot of us struggle with that throughout the career, to be honest.
The way you came to the career is really interesting. We sometimes visualise that, you know, someone knows they want to be a doctor from X age and they study like mad all the way, the right subjects through school, and they go and do their, you know, what's the first year called, their health science studies, and they've got to get their A's and it's all on track. It was different for you. You loved your TV shows, and that many people can do that, but there's a big gap between loving them and thinking I'd like to be a doctor and actually getting there. What was your path there and why?
Yeah, so I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was in high school, and I didn't really like being in high school. And so I actually left at the end of year 12 and went and did some work in admin for a while, and then decided, well, I guess I'd better go to uni. And at that time I was able to get in, and I started out doing economics as my major and then changed it to linguistics, and then started working at Parliament as an executive assistant, and still really didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, but eventually settled on medicine. In the book, I kind of blame my mum for that. I got to the last exam I sat at university, and I called her after the exam and I said, Mum, I'm done with study forever. And she said, that's lovely, dear. Now think about graduate entry medicine. Which, of course, eventually I did.
Why did she say that to you? Parents are so wise. Why did she say that to you? What did she see?
I think she probably saw how much I love working with people and how I like to use my brain. And I'm very interested in gaining knowledge and thinking about problems. But also that, I guess, applying that to working with people is the most important thing for my well-being. And, you know, we didn't know a lot of doctors socially. She, you know, my mum's a lawyer by training and a local politician, and she didn't know a lot of doctors socially, but just had a sense that that was a job that might suit me, and I guess she was right.
And so once you got going, you didn't look back. And that brings us forward then to this first year. There's a lot of humour in the book. There are similarities, some have noted, to This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay, but you do make clear the emotional, mental toll the job takes, especially as a junior doctor. And what are those? We've touched on the responsibility. What are some of the other pressures?
I think probably one of the big pressures for junior doctors is just time. You know, you spend a lot of time at work, and during that time at work, you're kind of always in a hurry. And there are always patients who need things done. And some of those patients need things done because they're really sick and you have to quickly attend to their needs so that they don't deteriorate further. And then some of the patients, you know, understandably, because they're in hospital and they don't have a lot of control over their lives and what's happening with their health at that time, feel very strongly that they should get their discharge papers on time, or feel very strongly that the nurses should give them a laxative or whatever it may be. So someone kind of always wants something from you while you're a junior doctor, and the job is a constant juggling of some of these really clinically risky, important, scary situations with some of these, I suppose, more mundane, but, you know, also important to the patients and important to their care situations. And all of the time you're trying to look out for that risky thing that no one's quite picked up on that might herald a deterioration that hasn't happened yet.
Also, just the challenge of trying to respect patients as much as you can and their families as much as you can under this kind of pressure. We had a fascinating interview recently with Ben Bravery, who became a doctor after having bowel cancer in his 20s, and in part because he wanted to do it differently from what he had been through. The Patient Doctor, that book is called. And it's not that it's deliberate, it's just that it's made so difficult. What were the experiences you have when you wanted to deliver bad news to people in the most human way possible, but, you know, the system made it difficult?
Yeah, I think it is really hard to practice, I guess, the ideal medicine and the kind, compassionate medicine that you hope to practice, while also managing both the time pressures and at times the, I guess, physical constraints of a hospital where you won't necessarily have access to a private room to talk to a patient about bad news that you want to deliver. And you won't necessarily have the time available to sit down for the amount of time that they really deserve to have that conversation. And so, you know, at times, even though we know it's not the best thing and we know it's the wrong thing to do, we end up having to deliver news to people in rooms where other patients are present, or rapidly, and then leaving them alone with their nurse to process what we've told them. And that's really hard.
Well, let's talk about the nurses. You were working at Middlemoor, as we said, which is one of the busiest, if not the busiest, of our hospitals. And you make it very clear the vital role that nurses have in the running of the hospital. You dedicate a whole chapter to it. Just explain more.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't run a hospital without nurses. My job as a doctor, or, you know, the job of the medical team, is to make a diagnosis about what's going on and then prescribe or direct the treatment that needs to happen. The only way that that treatment does happen is because the nurses deliver it. If it's a medication, the nurses, you know, administer the medication. If it's organising a scan, we request the scan, but then the nurses arrange the logistics of getting the patient there. And the nurses are the ones who are taking all of the, like the vital signs, as the book is called. So people's heart rate and blood pressure, and all of those things, to figure out if a patient might be deteriorating. And they're the ones noticing if something doesn't quite sit right and letting us know early. And in between all of that, they're also, you know, making sure that the patients are fed and that they've been able to get to the toilet and that they've had enough sleep, and remembering to see them as whole human beings and not a system of different organs that are working together to run a brain, I suppose. And that's really hard work, and it's really exhausting work. And, you know, junior doctors work very long hours, but we work a very different job to nurses. And a lot of our job is spent at a computer, not really interacting with patients in the same intense, constant way that the nursing staff are. And, you know, as we're all aware at the moment, there's a huge shortage of nurses in the country, and that puts even more pressure on the nurses that we do have. So, yeah, I mean, working with nurses, I think I say in the book, it's, you know, one of the best parts of getting to know a new ward and one of the saddest parts of leaving it. And I've worked with some incredible nurses, and I've had family members in hospital cared for by incredible nurses. Just think they're amazing, and we should pay them lots more money.
Well, you're up for it quite directly. You know, you say every member of the healthcare team's essential, but perhaps nobody more so than nurses. You're upfront about the short staffing, the terrible pay, and also some of what they put up with, including from patients. But there's one line that struck me as well. Nurses have saved my ass on more than one occasion. And is that because as you've pointed out, often they're vastly experienced, but also they're looking for those first clues all the time.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a thing they teach you very early on when you're a junior doctor, which is that, you know, one of the most important vital signs or one of the most important warnings about someone deteriorating is that the nurse is worried. And if a nurse tells you, hey, look, this patient just doesn't quite look right and I need you to see them, it's a very foolish junior doctor who ignores that. And I think that's something that we've probably all learned because we, you know, we go in being told this and then we, you know, get a little big for our boots and go, oh, yes, well, you know, their chart looks fine and all their vital signs look fine. And the nurse is right, you know, 9 times out of 10. So I've learned my lesson and I definitely listen when the senior nurses or, you know, when the person who's looking after the patient on the ground minute by minute doesn't think that things are going as well as I do.
You make commentary. Izzy Lomax-Sawyers is our guest. Her book is Vital Signs, Heartbreaking, Sometimes Hilarious Stories of a Junior Doctor's First Year, which she somehow penned during her first year during a pandemic. But she explained a little earlier that in some ways it was helping her process, I guess, her experiences. Let's pick up, Izzy. You make commentary on the state of mental health services in New Zealand, and you do this by a very personal story. Could you share more?
Yeah, so probably about a decade ago now, I had a friend, Hermione, and she was admitted to mental health care after a suicide attempt and unfortunately was very unwell and needed to be in hospital for a long time. She had a really severe depression with some psychosis, and so she was, you know, hearing things that the rest of us couldn't hear and seeing things we couldn't see. Her life was definitely saved by the mental health system, and it was saved by receiving shock treatment against her will, and it was saved by, you know, receiving medications, sometimes injected against her will when she wasn't able to, I guess, agree to the treatment on her own. And all of that was really hard, obviously, and at times it meant that those of us in her life were interfacing with a mental health system where, I guess, you know, which is an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, and where some of the staff that we interface with were burnt out and didn't always have the compassion that she needed and that we all needed going through this really hard thing. And I write in Vital Signs about working on a psych ward myself, and how I dreaded that because I was worried that I would work with people who were like the ones who had been cruel to my friend. And that wasn't my experience at all in the end. I found it really a very compassionate place, and that was quite healing for me in a way.
Your first full run as a house officer was in psychiatry, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I was kind of the GP of the psych ward, except without any of the skills and knowledge that a GP has. So we sought a lot of help from our senior colleagues. But my colleague Brittany and I were essentially the medical team, while the psychiatrists and registrars were the mental health team attached to the psych ward. And so we saw all of the patients and did physical examinations and ECGs and blood tests just to make sure their physical health was okay, at the same time that their mental health was being cared for.
What did you learn from your experience there about how it could be done well? And can you comment on what happens? I guess some call it compassion fatigue, some call it exhaustion. Could you comment a little bit further about the difference between this care being done well and not being done well? And do you have any insights into how and why that happens?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of facets to it. One thing that I think really impacts the care in a way that we don't necessarily think about until we experience the differences is the actual physical design of the place where people are cared for. You know, some of the psychiatric units in our country are, you know, old, musty, dusty buildings with essentially bars on the windows, right? And the unit where I worked, Te Aho Mai, is gorgeous. It's brand new. It's won an architectural award. And so that was a great start because it was light and airy and sunny, and our patients could, you know, go outside and still be safe and contained within the unit where they needed to be. And I think, yeah, I have mixed feelings about the term compassion fatigue, because I totally understand where it's coming from. And I also haven't met very many health professionals or people working, I guess, in compassionate ways who get sick of being compassionate. I think that it's the, you know, I think people get worn down by the exhaustion, as you say, and it's incredibly hard to be physically assaulted and verbally assaulted every day in your job. And you can hold on to the fact that it's not people's fault and that they're unwell. And at the same time, it's really, really difficult, and it chips away at you to be treated like that. And, you know, us doctors have it a lot easier because we don't spend as much time physically present on the floor, as they say. But I think that's something that's really hard for the nursing staff and the psych assistants who are working minute to minute to keep people safe.
You talk about the need for young doctors to be agents for change, to call out things in the medical industry or the medical profession that they don't think are right. And goodness, there's been so much endeavour to make change, whether it's training doctors in issues of equity and inequity, of cultural awareness, of unconscious bias, of how to talk to people as people when they are under, you know, pressure and time, but delivering life-altering news. What's the particular role that young doctors can play in the ongoing efforts to improve how these things work?
I think that as young doctors and as junior doctors, we have a role in, you know, I guess leading from the bottom, or, you know, managing up in terms of the less compassionate ways of doing things. And, you know, we can make suggestions on the ward round that, oh, maybe this conversation might be one that we could have in private. And I also think that probably our most important role as juniors, as well as trying to change the things that we see day to day, and as well as, you know, trying to make sure that the team that we're working with see every patient as an individual and have equity in mind, I think that holding on to our own beliefs and values about that and acting them out until we're senior enough to make a change is a surprisingly challenging aspect of the job. You wouldn't think it would be hard to keep on believing that you need to, you know, practice medicine with compassion. And to be fair, I don't think that anyone in medicine believes anything differently, but holding on to the practice of that day after day with the pressures that you're under is an important role for juniors, because one day we'll be the person modelling this behaviour for our juniors, and we'll be the consultant leading the team that needs to break news to someone. And so I try to hold on to that, and every day I suppose I get more compassion for those who haven't been able to hold on to it, because it's really hard doing that when you're always under the immense pressure that you are under in the health system.
It's really interesting that you say that. And the other thing that you touch on, there's so many funny things here. There's quirky things, like I don't know why hospitals don't supply pens, but they don't apparently.
I know.
You get lunch provided free because, let's face it, you're never getting a lunch break. You're not leaving the premises to go to the caf. But, you know, there's some really interesting little insights here. And another is that you often end up being friends with other doctors, friends and, you know, having a lot of your relationships with other doctors. And is that just simply a matter of time, you know, that it's hard to have a quote unquote normal life outside of where you work?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, you spend most of your time at work, so the people you work with kind of become your main social contact, I suppose. It sounds sad, but it is what it is. And when you get home from work, you're pretty drained, and the people that understand that are other doctors, and the people that understand that, hey, you said you could make it to dinner at 7, but there's a patient deteriorating and you really can't safely leave the hospital. Other doctors understand that, and it can be really hard for people who haven't worked in that environment to understand why you can't just hand over and move on with your day because your shift's over. But it's just not how it works for us. And so certainly, even if we have the best intentions to be balanced humans with a life outside of medicine, I think we do gravitate towards being friends with each other.
Look, lots of quirky things. The cliques and hierarchies crack me up. They're not quite what you might anticipate, sort of senior to junior. They're the specialties. There's a lot of fun in this. And just a bit of feedback, Izzy, before you go. I'm listening to Izzy. I'm a GP. I've been a doctor for nearly 40 years. I started as a junior doctor at the age of 23 with no life experience. I've made mistakes, though not too many. But at 3 a.m. when I'm having a bad night's sleep, every one of those comes back to me and I run through how I should have done things differently. You get used to the responsibility, but you never get used to your own failings. I wish Izzy all the best for her career. With her insight, I know she's going to be a very fine doctor. Thanks, Izzy, and thanks for the book.
Thanks so much.
Izzy Lomax-Sawyer's Vital Signs is her book, published by Allen and Unwin.